Well, this is a look. This is a really fascinating series. And how can you fix the world? This doesn't sound weird, but I genuinely am fascinated by what people think. I love really genuinely hearing what people think about things and why they think the way they think. What's given rise to the ideas they have, and how does that fit in with their other thoughts about? And I just love exploring people's thoughts on these things. And so this series is fascinating. We went to the community, as you know, many of you will know, last year for quite a period of time, and asked the community what they thought would fix the world. How would you fix the world? And it's been hearing various answers and so on raised for me a massive, massive questions. As I've heard people say, I mean, I've heard speaking to people at various contexts, they gave their answers. And I had one man give an answer about it that it was totally fascinating. And I was gobsmacked about how he thought we could fix the world and what the problems were. And I must say, I was lost for words. I didn't quite know how to, and I had to move away and so on. But lots of the stuff that's come in has been very, very intriguing and interesting. And what do you do to fix the world? Now, of course, there's an assumption buried in that, isn't it, that the world needs fixing. Perhaps 2 weeks ago, you might have thought it didn't, but gee, the last 2 weeks have just been devastating worldwide, and it's obvious the world is broken. But what do you do? How do you fix it? Well, the answers have come in 4 big packages, and we've had the largest group, 25% of the people that we surveyed gave this answer: fix people. Now, that itself is right there. I'm fascinated. People who have said, you know, how do you fix the world? Fix people. Now, if you hear that answer or have asked that question or said that answer, what it begs other questions, doesn't it? Someone says, how do you fix the world? Fix people. I want to know a whole bunch more things. Like, I'll give you a couple of things that I'm kind of fascinated by. Do you think, so if this morning you that was your answer, I'd try and fix people. Do you think the problem is people, and so to fix people fixes the problem? Or do you think it's just part of the problem? That's one of the things. Because what I'm trying to wrestle with, do you actually think the problem with the world is people? And if we can just fix them? That's one of the things I'd love to dig in with you and see where you're thinking about this. But the other thought is too, when you've suggested fix people, if this was your answer, when you've suggested fix people, did you include yourself? No? Well, that's honest, isn't it? So fix the world, fix people. But I mean those people out there. Is that perhaps how you think? I mean, I'm curious and interested. It's fascinating. There was a very famous story about the Times newspaper in England who asked prominent writers to write an essay on what the problem with the world is. And under a big heading of what's the problem with the world, they'd present these essays. Now, I've memorised one of the essays that was written. Very impressive. It was many decades ago, and I've worked at it for quite some time. Now, I'm going to give it word for word. He wrote the answer to this question, what's the problem with the world, so it would be published, and it went like this. Dear editor, I am G.K. Chesterton. Now, that's, you can see why it's easy to memorise, can't you? But yeah, and wouldn't you be dirty if you're one of the blokes, one of the women who's written the massive, long, complex essay, and his one comes in like 2 words, I am. But it's a very insightful thought. He's not just saying people are, he's saying he as a person is the problem. And I dare say what he's suggesting is we are, therefore. Is it the case that if you gave the answer this morning, were you including yourself? With that same kind of perhaps humility that G.K. Chesterton had, that I am, we are the problem. Now, I don't know. I think generally it wasn't in people's minds when they gave this answer. It's generally, I think people are imagining it's those ones out there, those ones who are doing the bad things. But this is an insightful answer nonetheless. People are the problem. And it's a critical issue. It's very pessimistic. People are the problem. People, we've got to fix them. Now, is that the case? Now, my job this morning is to show you what the Bible has to say on these things. I mean, it's a waste of time coming to hear me. But to hear what the Bible has to say, to hear what Jesus has to say, will be very, very, very helpful. And I want to suggest right up front, be ready to be shocked by what Jesus has to say. Now, it's easy to actually dig into what Jesus has to say about this topic because this is the Bible's topic. If you want to know what the Bible's about, I didn't. I grew up in a home where I didn't go to church, weren't kind of Christian family and so on. They just, I didn't have a Bible. And I thought the Bible was just a bunch of proverbial sayings. I thought it was, you know, like stitch in time saves nine and, you know, just a whole bunch of statements like this. That's what I thought it was. Until I actually started to read it as an adult and was quite shocked and surprised that it is actually, it's teaching something. It's saying something about the world over many centuries by different authors in history and events and so on. It's a revelation of what people are like. But more importantly, it was a revelation. I was shocked to find this. It was a revelation that the God who exists was determined to fix the world and to repair the problem. And Jesus is the climax of that God's determination to fix the world. So that with the coming of Jesus, as I began to keep reading through the Bible, with the coming of Jesus, he was the fulfillment of the hopes of a solution that had been prepared for centuries. And he came with great expectation at his birth. If you're with us at Christmas time at all, perhaps you came through that period as well. But at Christmas time, we remember the birth of Jesus. And at his birth, there were those wonderful words, weren't there? I bring you good news of great joy that will be for all the people. Today in the town of David, a Saviour has been born. He is Christ the Lord. Jesus' activity and teaching when he grew up reflected this same thing. He was concerned about a problem and he came to fix it. He was the great final answer of the God of the universe to this problem. Now, I keep mentioning this, that the Bible reveals the problem because it spends a lot of time on this topic. What is the problem? Where does the problem really lie? And it can seem so simple, but it's not. What the Bible has to say about the problem is deep and shocking. The Bible, Jesus, spends considerable time on it because it isn't easy for us as humans to get. And I want to show you that. I'm going to show you that by looking at a part of the Bible which came up on the... let's see if we can throw it back up on the screen. I don't actually know who's up in the box there, but there we go. This is a part of an account of the life of Jesus written by a man called Mark, a contemporary a near contemporary who has spoken about the eyewitness accounts of the person of Jesus through Peter, actually. But the context here is given to us, and we'll come to that. Just keep that up there. We'll come to that in a second. But the context is that Jesus is speaking to a group of religious leaders who were all concerned about rituals to keep clean before God, rituals of washing and various ceremonies, whilst at the same time being hypocrites, being full of hypocrisy. Now, Jesus kind of sees all of this and brings a critique against them. He was no shrinking violet, Jesus, if you read about him in the Bible, an extraordinary figure. But then he goes on and he gathers the crowd and he says this to them. He says, listen to me, everyone, and understand this. Nothing outside a person can defile them by going into them. Rather, it's what comes out of a person that defiles them. Now, flip back up again. After he'd said that, he left the crowd and entered the house, and his disciples asked him about this parable. Now, get this. See those first two sentences? That's kind of pretty straightforward, wouldn't you think? Nothing outside a person makes them unclean, like makes them polluted before God, corrupted by going in. Rather, it's what comes out. It's kind of pretty straightforward. But the disciples, he says, are dull. Are you so dull? Why do you have to ask me about this? This is so obvious. Well, why do they have to ask him? Because they don't get it. Because what Jesus is actually saying is counterintuitive, countercultural, and counterpopular thinking. And let me give you some sense of how counter it is. In fact, I'm going to, if you're with us last week, you'll know we did this last week, but I'm on this quest to get husbands and wives actually talking together, so we're going to talk to each other again this morning. So what I want to do is talk to the person next to you or just around you, and I want you to ask this question, work out together, what percentage of the population do you think would say that humans are basically good. 20%, 30%, 40%. What percentage of humans do you think would answer the question that, and say that we are basically good? What are people like? Basically good? What percent would say yes? Now go for it. If you're married, first time to say hello this morning, catch up. Okay, that's enough. Stop. All right, now I'm going to get you to do a quick... We've got some real actions this morning. We've got a visual aid coming soon too. What I want you to do is put your hand up if you think you think more than 30% of people think we're basically good. Hands up. Okay. Keep them up if you think it's more than 40%. More than 50%. If you've gone down, more than 60%. If you've more gone down, more than 70%. A few more, 80, a lot more, 90, more than 95. Well, there are some real pessimists amongst us. Or very generous people, perhaps that's another way of putting it. Let me give you the stats from America. I know it's America, but stats from America say that 87% of Americans think that humans are basically good. In church, the statistic is 77% of people in church think humans are basically good. And when you just consider mainline denominations in America, it goes up over 90% think people are basically good. Now, did I hear a laugh? I don't know what you think, and I've deliberately not asked what you think, whether you think people are basically good or not. But what I want you to do is notice what Jesus says. Now, if that's the percentage of people who think people are basically good, I imagine that if we were in the crowd, 90% of us would take Jesus aside and say, "What are you saying?" Not because we haven't understood what he said, but because we can't quite believe he's saying it. You see what he says? "Are you so dull? Don't you see that nothing that enters a person from the outside can defile and pollute them before God?" Go to the next slide, thank you. "For it doesn't go into their heart, but into their stomach and then out the body." In saying this, Jesus was declaring all foods clean, an issue that we need to get into at some point. But he went on, "What comes out of a person is what defiles them, for it is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come. Sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance and folly. All these evils come from inside and defile a person." What? If Jesus was asked the question, "Do you think people are basically good?" his answer would be an unequivocal no. Now that cuts right across the grain of popular thinking. And I'm actually trying to highlight it for you that what we have here is what Jesus thinks and what people think, and they are at odds. I want you to see that this morning. Now, I want to persuade you of Jesus, but I want you to see that we actually have a clash, even amongst people who are going to church. There's a clash. Now, that's astonishing. But it is a popular view today. A famous psychologist, a man called Maslow, some of you will have heard of this name, he said this: "We don't have any intrinsic instincts for evil." Maslow, Jesus. It's from what comes from inside that produces all of this evil. Well, you ask Maslow, where did evil come from? How come evil happens in our world? And his answer would be, it's culture. It's the effects, the polluting and corrupting effects of the external realities of culture around us that does it to us. Jesus would say, there's nothing that's outside that does that. It all comes from within. You know, Maslow, of course, is a very positive, affirming person. He's very positive and affirming of people. You went to Maslow and there's nothing evil in you. There's no instinct for evil in you. It's just basically good. That's a lovely thought to hear. Jesus is very pessimistic about people. Now, if all that matters, of course, is being positive and affirming, I'm going with Maslow. But if you are interested in the truth, then let's think about who is right. You know, the world of literature has wrestled with this topic. It's a big topic. In the, I'm taking you way back now, but in the 1850s, there was a book that came out, 1848, I think it is, a book called Coral Island. Now, some of you will have heard it. It was a very famous book, and I think it's still in print. It hasn't been out of print since the 1850s. Extraordinary record. But it's about three boys who were shipwrecked on a Pacific island, three English boys, and when they are shipwrecked on this island, they are confronted by the external impact of evil. But they, because they're young boys now with the corrupting influence of society removed, they begin to bring order and goodness to this place. It's part of a movement, this book of thought that was shared by intellectuals of the time. It was part of what's called the movement of the Enlightenment and kind of 17th century, 18th century and so on, where there was a return to the thinking about human reason as the basis for everything. And in that light, we've kind of cast off external revelation. We don't need someone from outside of humanity to tell us what to think. We now can think it ourselves. In that light, thinkers began to be very positive about humankind and what we are like. And so Coral Island was kind of born in this context. But then something happened. It was called the War to End All Wars, the First World War, which was followed shortly after by the Second World War. Listen to some quotes from thinkers after those events. This is by a man called Langdon Gilkey, who was a teacher in China during the outbreak of the Second World War, and he was interned in a Japanese prison of war camp for 2.5 years, with incidentally, well, not actually, I'll come back to it, with a man called Eric Liddell. Interesting, the man of Chariots of Fire fame. But listen to what Langdon Gilkey wrote. One of the peculiar conceits of modern optimism, a conceit which I had fully shared, is the belief that in time of crisis, the goodness of men comes forward. Nothing indicates so clearly the fixed belief in the innate goodness of humans as does this confidence that when the chips are down and we are revealed for what we really are, we will be all good to each other. Nothing could be so totally in error, says Langdon, after 2.5 years in a prison of war camp, seeing not just the atrocities against the prisoners, but the prisoners. He wrote a book reflecting on a journal that he wrote during that time. There was one person who stood out as different, and it was Eric Liddell. Now, I'll come back to him in a little while. There's another writer, a lady called Dorothy Sayers. She was an author, novelist, essayist around the World War period, and she said this: "We were given to believe that we are basically good, evolving higher, essentially teachable, and so the appalling outburst of bestial ferocity in the totalitarian states, the stupid endless greed and the exploitation of capitalist society were inexplicable. Not just shocking, not even just alarming. They were the utter negation of everything we were led to believe. When people were confronted with humanity, where civilizing forces were removed, rather than the innate goodness pouring forth and producing something wonderful, human bestiality came forth and sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance and folly came out." You know, there was a book written after the Second World War, and I've mentioned this to you before, but Lord of the Flies. You were all made to read it at school. Lord of the Flies was a book written by Golding, and it was written by him as a direct critique of Coral Island. The three main characters in the book Lord of the Flies were parallels to the three boys of Coral Island, and Coral Island is given explicit reference in the last pages of the book when the Royal Navy officer makes mention of it. He's deliberately critiquing it. Came out in the 1950s after the Second World War, do you see it? And his book was to say that when you put a bunch of English boys on a desert island and take the civilizing effects of society away from them and the external pressures of culture away from them and the parents away from them, what you get is not innate goodness coming out, but bestiality. You get all that's terrible and dreadful. You know, the concentration camps, world wars, brought this out with great clarity. But you don't need to have gone through a concentration camp or a world war to have worked this out. You just need to be a parent, which I know for many of you feels like being in a concentration camp, but you just need to be a parent. And again, I've told you this, I haven't got many stories, so I'll just give you the same ones again and again. But I was sitting with a friend of mine at a pool, a play of sport down there, and I was sitting with this man, and I said to him, he'd become a father a short time before. I said, "How's parenthood going?" And he said, "It's dreadful." And I said, "What's happened?" He said, "We have loved this child. We've done everything good for this child. We've been generous and kind and compassionate. And she's two and she's evil. She's rude. She's selfish." And you're all laughing because if you're just having a child now, you're probably not laughing. You're probably going, "What am I in for?" But you see the point, friends. If you have a child, you realize that if goodness was natural, if I was basically good, you would expect that the feelings and expression of gratitude would just come forth naturally. But instead, we've had to tell all our kids to say thank you. Say thank you. Say thank you or I'll beat you kindly, gently, and so on. But, you know, like, I've got to punish you to say thank you. Because as a child ages, what comes out more and more, and the parenting is not actually to bring out the innate goodness. The parenting is actually to constrain what's by nature there and help train them in another way. Now, I don't know how you're feeling right now as you've come to church with us. You came thinking I was going to hear about, people might have problems and we want to seek to fix them. How are we going to do that? But when you go to Jesus, what you find is it's not just that people have got problems. What you find when you go to Jesus is that the depth of the problem is profound. It inheres with us. The evil that is in the world has come from within, says Jesus. Now that is an astonishing truth. I don't know that you expect that to happen all of a sudden. It's gone worse. You know, I was about to go on holidays many years ago now. I was about to take the family away and I thought I'd just better check. I don't know why I did this, but I thought I'd better just check it because I pulled out my wallet to check my license. I can't remember why, but I think it was because I hadn't noticed any renewal things for a while. I thought, strike, it's out of date. My license, I don't want to get caught in the road and stop driving and ruin the holiday. And I also want to do the right thing and obey the law. So I went off to the RTA or RMS or whatever it is now, and I went off there just to get my license fixed. And, get your license fixed, how big a job is that? I was just going to go in and pay my money and get it renewed and go back out and it'll all be sweet. I went in, they said, "Just give us a second." "Just give another second." "Actually, give me 10 minutes. I sat down. They came back and said, "Give us your license plate of your car. That might be a way that we can't find your records." So I gave them a license plate of the car. Half an hour later, called me over, number 582. "Come over." And I came over and said, they said, "Your car doesn't exist." And I said, "What? I'm just fix my license." "Well, actually, we've tried to get your light. We don't actually have you on it. We don't have your car on the record. Where do you live?" "Gave them my address." "We don't have that address on record either." "Oh, maybe it's one." "No, it's not the one before that. Maybe it's the one before." "It wasn't the one. I've moved quite a number of times, racing and hiding from people." It ended up an address they'd found me there, and they'd been sending all my registration and license forms to that address for many years. And I'd not seen them. And so I went just to get one little thing fixed, found not only wasn't my license, I wasn't registered, my car wasn't registered, my kids didn't belong to me, and neither was I married. Do you know what I mean? Like my whole world just fell apart. And you know, it's kind of like that this morning, a little bit like that. I don't know, you've kind of come going, it's intriguing. Fix people. Yeah, those people need to be fixed. But then what I'm saying is you look at Jesus' teaching and you go, wow, he's saying something quite scary about me. It's not just that I was brought up in a bad neighbourhood. It's not just that culture's corrupting. He's saying that it's in me, that all the adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, that actually comes from who I am. That's not how I want to think about myself. You know, the Bible, let me take you a little bit further. I mean, the Bible is saying there's a problem with humanity, with me, with each of us that's deep. But it goes even further. It traces it back to a deeper problem, a problem we have with God. And I want to now show you this visually. Now, forgive me, because I sometimes think visual illustrations are juvenile, and so to avoid it appearing juvenile, I've made it really big and got someone else to do it. This is for you who are visual learners. Spin it, oh, assistant.
I can do this all day.
It does, just keep going, doesn't it? Okay, now spin it again. Ah, now what is that? Thank you, you may sit down. Give him an applause. Now, was it juvenile? Now, what the Bible says is quite profound. It says that when a human life is connected with God at the center, it works. But when God's pushed off the center, when humans step out from God, step away from God, put God at arm's length, life doesn't spin. Well, actually, no, there's some of you who are glass half full people. Is it true to say it didn't spin? You're a glass half full person. What do you say?
Wobbly.
Hey?
It's a bit wobbly.
A bit wobbly. It span really fast in one part, and it span really slow on the other, and then kind of wobbled and stopped and needed to be. So it did kind of spin. Now, here's the deal. What the Bible says is when you step out, when you take God out of centre, humanity becomes this mix of we can do really good things, but then we have a really tough time going back up again and we get stuck. You know, after Lent, there was a wonderful outpouring of "I'll ride with you." But how long did that last? After the Paris situation, there was an extraordinary outpouring of "we'll stand with you." But how long will that last? And in fact, aren't we now seeing mosques firebombed and so on? Humanity is this incredible mix of potential for good, but gravity towards bad. The nature of us is bent in, and we can stretch for a moment up, but then slide back down again. That is the shape of the humankind. We are broken. Husbands and wives, I find it extraordinary, always reflect on this, that we choose the one person we get on with the best to marry. And how does it go? For a time, really well. But it's often patchy. It's often really tough. The person I chose that I got on really well with, I find that hard. And you get to a crisis point where we've got to fix this, and it goes well for about 6 hours. And then back into the old patterns. Why is that? Because everywhere Andrew Heard goes, he takes this heart that's broken. Every situation I go into, I corrupt it because of who I am, not because of external situations. Do you see it? We have managed to make society work. Of all the systems of governance and philosophy of life, we've managed to make Western society work. You know, communism and socialism, in many ways, is far more humane. The ethic, the theory of communism is from each according to ability to each according to need. That is a beautiful sentiment. From each according to ability, not too much from everyone, just according to your ability, to each according to need, so that no one will be in need. It's a beautiful sentiment, but it never worked. Why? Because for it to work, it assumed humans are basically generous. And it just can't work because humans are basically selfish. Capitalism works wonderfully. And its credo is, from each as little as possible, from others as much as I can get. And it works brilliantly. And it's functioning powerfully because its assumption is Jesus' assumption about humankind. Now, again, as I say, I don't know what you came thinking this morning was going to be about. But when you look at Jesus, when you look at the Bible, you find that the problem with the world is bigger and deeper. And I tell you, the fourth week, so next couple of weeks, there's some intriguing, interesting material. We're going to get some stuff on freedom and what it looks like to be free. We're going to get some stuff on authorities. It's going to be, but the last week, we're going to actually put a whole new piece in this issue of the problem with the world. When you come to the Bible, you see the problems are far deeper, and the problem is evidence of something far more serious and far more critical. It's actually evidence of a problem with God. The human race has a problem with its creator. That's why it's broken. Life may not work for you in your context, but that's a small issue compared to the thing the Bible draws our attention to. It's a small issue compared to the whole humanity problem, which we're all in. The Bible is effectively saying, see this about yourselves, see this about the world, because it's a signpost to something larger, a God concern. We've been busy just trying to make our lives work and manage work, but there's this God thing happening, and the Bible is saying, notice it. Lift your eyes and see what's happening across humanity, the shape of who we are, because there's a problem with humanity that will not just go away. Notice it, see it. Why? Well, not just to get depressed about it. Because this Jesus who is compelling us to see these things, that it's an internal problem, it's not an external problem, it's not fixing outside that's going to fix inside, you need to fix, he's got the solution. He has the solution. A few chapters later, he actually says these words, I have come not to be served, but to serve, and to give my life as a ransom for many. The Christian message is this radical one, unique message that says it's not just a set of new laws that will change the world. It's not just a set of rituals. It's not just a set of performances that will change the world. We need a heart transplant. We need a whole new nature. And the only religion that talks at that level and offers that kind of change is the Christian one. It talks about a God who comes into the world, who gives up his own, in the most heartwarming, heart-transforming, God comes and he gives forgiveness and mercy to people who are by nature broken. He comes and gives mercy. He comes and gives forgiveness by himself paying the price that we ought to have paid before him. By dying the death we ought to have died. And by that gracious gift, God makes it possible for us to come back, to bring our lives back centered where they were made to be centered, on God. With a heart that's forgiven and transformed from the inside, more of which we'll look at in weeks to come. It is an extraordinary message. One that's not about oppressive new rules, but about a transformation of life from the inside so that you are freed and liberated. More next week. It's a wonderful, profound message that it's only got if you understand how deep the problem is, how deep the need is. Now, I've got a couple of quick things to say at the end, but we're going to go some questions, and I think I've done okay. Is that right?
Can I grab the a slide with the text number up as well? That'd be great. Yep. Here's a question to kick off on, and it's one that a few were down this track. If God is good and he exists, why does he let evil happen?
Okay. It's a good question. It's one that's asked often, and it kind of goes along the same lines of, if God's so good and loving, why did he make the world like it is? And the assumption seems to be that if God got it right, if God made the world perfect, then people wouldn't do this. But the problem with that is it's an assumption about perfection. I'll give you this. What is a perfect world? Is a perfect world where people are so constrained and controlled they can't choose bad? Is that the perfect world? Is a perfect human a person who cannot, even if they wanted to, choose bad? Nah, that's Robotsville. That's Oppressiveville. Perfection, when God makes humans in his image perfect, he makes them with the capacity for choice. One of the very important comments that have been made by thinkers, a man called C.S. Lewis made the comment that hell is testimony to human dignity. And the point he was making is this, that the fact that we can make choices for God or against God and be held accountable for those choices dignifies us as humans. It says we are real people with real choices, with real consequences, where your choices are taken seriously. So God, the loving God, if he were less than loving, he would make it so that we couldn't choose bad. But that would be because he'd make us imperfectly. And so the consequences of a world where God has made us perfectly to be people who can make real choices for good or bad and have consequences attached to those choices is the world we're living in. There you go.
There's another one. The person asking the question says, although they basically do agree with you, surely what we expose ourselves to does influence our behaviour.
Yeah, this is good. This is good. Absolutely. External influences have an influence, but they have an influence because they find a ready acceptance in a heart that's polluted and corrupted already. Do you see? Now, I'll give you there's a few reasons why this is important to get hold of. One of them's parenting. One of them's parenting. If I assume my child is basically good, I won't take as much heed to external influences because the basic goodness will come out. But if I assume my child has a heart, as Jesus says, my child has that heart, I will take much greater care to ensure that external influences aren't grabbed hold of by that heart that's broken. Do you see? Because if the heart is like it is, it doesn't take much to set it further down that path because external influences will take you further. But the point to be made by Jesus is that those things take you further only because they find a heart that is broken. And so parenting is about taking measures in the early years to constrain and protect and guard to form new habits that might, under God by his grace, guard and protect as the years go on.
All right, I'll read out one more from the text line, then we might throw it open and do a bit of back and forth there. But so two questions came in down this track. If Jesus is the fulfillment of fixing the problem, if he's come to fix the problem, teaching what he did, then why is the world still so messed up?
Yeah. This is very good. For Jesus to remove all evil completely, he would have to remove every skerrick of it. Now, if he's right and evil resides in the human heart, then to remove evil completely from the world right today, at lunchtime, to remove evil from the world right at lunchtime would mean which of us would survive? Not a one. And so, 2 Peter chapter 3. What you have is this message in the Bible that God is intent on removing evil from the world forever. But the only way that can be done and have as many as possible rescued from it is to have a rescuer who grips and takes hold of some by their acknowledgement of their brokenness of their heart, their turning to Jesus, putting him back at the centre. He takes hold of some so that he has a hold of many of us by his grace and kindness, so that when he does strip the world, some of us by him will be kept through into the next one by his grace and kindness. So he's leaving the brokenness as it is at present, because that's the only way in which more can find a way of escape through the grace that is given to us in Jesus. So we still carry around this body of death, though if you've come to Christ, you have been forgiven and renewed. You still carry around with your body of death, and we wait, Romans 8. We'll look at this in weeks to come, actually, the redemption that is finally to appear. Throw open?
Yeah, open up.
Sorry, Ian, down here, we'll come to you, yeah?
If we have all those evil things within in our heart and we get a heart transplant and give our life to God, do we no longer have them in our heart? Do we no longer bleed?
Yeah, no, similar. So do we no longer have these things if we've had a heart transplant? No, similar point. We still carry around this body of death, this habitual brokenness that is still part of us that won't be entirely stripped away until the return of Christ, until a new order, until a new creation. And so we await with eager expectation that hope to come. So we live in this period today, says the Bible, of kind of we have it but still have the mix residing, because if it's all taken away, then there's no hope for others. Sorry, I mentioned the beginning, came across a very
unusual account of...
Oh, the problem. Yeah, it was a lifeguard who just kind of had this really intriguing way of thinking about it, and it was quite difficult to understand in the end. And so we didn't have time to dig into it, and I can share it with you perhaps privately. Yeah, it was interesting.
Might ask another one from the text line here. It's similar to maybe the first question that was asked, but why didn't God do it right the first time? Why didn't he just make us all right?
Yeah, why didn't God make it right the first time? Well, there's the point earlier that he did make it right. He did make it right. He made people exactly how he intended to make them, which was they had the possibility of real choice. They weren't controlled robots. Real choice to make choices for or against him. He made it exactly the way he intended it. To make it otherwise would be to make us less than human, because our dignity as humans is found in having choice that has consequences. That is real human dignity. Painful, especially if you're a parent and you've seen this. Parents who have seen their kids grow and begin to make choices they don't like, you can't stop that unless you want to crush their humanity. It's what it is to be human, is to have choices and have freedom to make choices and have the consequences that come. You can't take it away. And if you do, you will crush who they are. It's the I'll finish on this. It's the moth, the butterfly in a cocoon. You see the moth, the butterfly, trying to escape, kind of choose a small hole in the cocoon and squeeze its way out. And the soft-hearted sentimental see this poor thing trying to squeeze out through this very tiny hole and kind of cuts open the hole to make it easy for it to come out. But as it comes out deformed. Because it actually, by squeezing out through the hole, forces the fluids into all its kind of appendages and wings and so on to bring it to its full maturity. And the very process is the means by which it is who it is and what it is. Humanity, we wish we could just take all the evil away. But the only way to do that is to remove human responsibility and human choice, and that will deform us and make us less than truly human. The dignity of choice is a powerful thing. But let me finish by saying these couple of comments, actually. Why does it matter to get this? Well, it matters because the way you live life will be distorted if you don't take seriously the true nature of what a human is. You won't parent properly. You won't govern properly. You'll be shocked and surprised by the way people behave. You won't prepare yourself properly for life because you'll find yourself unguarded, thinking I'm basically good, when you find you're capable of incredible, dreadful things. You didn't realise that. Well, Jesus has taught us exactly what we are like. Be prepared, be warned, be careful. But secondly, signpost. Getting hold of this is a signpost to there being a greater problem. To there being something about humanity that is deeper and more profound and more serious in our relationship with God. These things are signposts to indicate that we need to deal with God. But lastly, if you don't get this kind of stuff, I would suggest to you it will create inadvertently perhaps a pride. A pride that thinks you don't need forgiveness. If you think you're basically good, you will tend to imagine that I'll be able to front up to God, if there is one, and it will go okay. But if our heart, my heart, is as Jesus says it is, then fronting up to God will be a terrifying experience. Because I may not have murdered, but I have a heart that has hate in it. I may not have committed adultery, but I have a heart that has lust in it. And I may not have expressed it, but it's there. This is me. I have no hope before a holy God except by the mercy that comes through the gift of Jesus. These are great warnings for us about dealing with things of great seriousness through the only means possible, which is Jesus.